Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting to you today, as usual, from the Red Beard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also known as Ottawa. Welcome to episode 60. Wow, can't believe I've gotten this far. So what are we talking about today? Well, after my chat with historian Lubomir Luchuk of the Royal Military College of Canada, we're returning to the chronological narrative of the Second World War on the Eastern Front. Because we're roughly tracking the war 81 years later, we've now reached early November 1943. That means we have to catch up a little bit and look at the events in September and October of 1943. Those include the Red Army's crossing of the Dnipro River and into the western half of Ukraine. But before we get to that, let's look at what else is happening in the war. 1st October, 1943. An uprising of Neapolitans frees their city, Naples, from German occupation. 3rd October, the Germans conquer the Greek island of Kos and commit a massacre. 4th October, Free French forces liberate the island of Corsica. 10th October, Chiang Kai-shek formally becomes the chairman of the Nationalist Government of China. 12th October, Italy declares war on Germany. This may surprise some people. It's complicated. After the deposition and arrest of dictator Benito Mussolini, who was later rescued by German special forces and set up in his own special rump puppet state, but that's a story for a different podcast, the new Italian government joins the Western Allies and fight against Germany. 14 October. A small resistance group of Jewish prisoners of the Sobibor extermination camp kill 11 SS officers and several guards. This allows 300 of the 600 in the camp to escape. 18 October, the Third Moscow Conference begins. This was a meeting of diplomats, ministers, and generals, but not the national leaders. That's why it's not as prominent in most histories. Among the people meeting in Moscow were the UK Foreign Minister Anthony Eden, the US Secretary of State Cordell Hull, and Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov, among others. The outcome was an agreement on how to deal with European states after the war, which included independence for each one, and it included destroying fascism in Italy and prosecuting all war crimes. 3rd October, throughout October and November, Western Allied forces continued their slow, painful advance north up the Italian peninsula. By the 31st of October, they are stalled by the weather just south of Rome. 1st November, 1943. U.S. Marines land on Bougainville in the Solomon Islands, east of Papua New Guinea. And this begins a battle that will last until the end of the war. 5th November 1943, Italian fascists bomb the Vatican in an attempt to knock out Vatican Radio. While many details remain murky even to this day, it seems that fascists felt the Vatican was sending coded messages to the Allies. 12th November. Germans take the Dodecanese Islands in the Aegean Sea from British forces. 15th November. The head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, declares gypsies are on the same level as Jews, and thus, logically, to be placed in concentration camps. 16 November. American bombers hit a heavy water factory and hydroelectric facility in German-occupied Vemork, Norway. 19 November. Another mass escape from a concentration camp, this time from Yanoska near Lviv, Ukraine. However, most of the escapers are soon recaptured and murdered. 20 November, the U.S. Marines land on Tarawa in the Western Pacific, northeast of the Solomon Islands. They suffer heavy losses. Meanwhile, British troops continue a slow advance north along Italy's eastern side. 22 November, U.S. President Roosevelt, British PM Churchill, and Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek meet in the Cairo Conference to discuss ways to defeat Japan. Stalin told the others he did not want to attend because the USSR was not at war with Japan, having signed a non-aggression pact in 1939. Apparently, Stalin said that meeting Chiang might anger Japan. But let's not forget, the USSR was aiding the Chinese communists, led by Mao Zedong. 23 November. Allied bombing on Berlin destroys the Deutsche Opernhaus, or German Opera House, a key symbol for the Nazi Party. 28 November, the Tehran Conference begins. Stalin did attend this one, along with Roosevelt and Churchill, in the Iranian capital. Here they discuss strategy for defeating Germany, and on the 30th of November, agree that the Western Allies would invade Europe in June 1944, in an operation codenamed Overlord. Stalin now has the second front, or he's been promised the second front that he's been asking for. Although, really, the Western Allies have a front in Europe, and have had one since September. Italy. So let's return to the progress of the war on the Eastern Front, or in the Eastern Theater. Right now, we're looking at the autumn of 1943. So in the previous narrative episode, we saw the Wehrmacht retreat westward to the Ost Wall, the Eastern Wall, its series of defensive positions stretching from the Baltic to the Black Seas. The southern part of it they called the Wotan Line, named for the Teutonic god. Most of it ran southeast along the Dnieper River, down to where it makes this great bend to the southwest at Zaporizhia. The Wotan line then went more or less straight south across the flatlands of Ukraine to the Sea of Azov. Now, their thinking was that by withdrawing to defensive positions, it would give them more time to rebuild. And they would also be able to free up some of their divisions from the east to send west to hold the Allies back in Italy. Now, this is all defensive thinking, very different from its offensive thinking of, what, not even half a year earlier. And that is something that we have to bear in mind for the rest of this episode. Now, as they retreated, the Germans destroyed as much as they could in a scorched earth policy. That was much more devastating, effective, and thorough than the Soviets had managed in their retreat 2 years earlier. They were German, after all. In addition to destroying bridges, power plants, and public buildings, the Germans burned farms and villages and took thousands of head of cattle, as well as any other food that they could find, leaving the surviving inhabitants of Ukraine to starve. But that strategy did not work out, at least not the way the Germans had planned. The Red Army was on their heels all the way. For example, as described in episode 57, the Kalinin Front, under General Andrei Yeremenko, broke through the positions of the German Army Group Center into Smolensk. By the 26th of September, the Red Army had the city. So if you need to refresh your memory, go back to episode 57, after you finish this episode, that is. The first units of the Red Army reached the Dnipro River, which more or less divides Ukraine in half, on 21st September. These units were from the 9th Mechanized Corps and were soon followed by the 52nd Guards Tank Brigade. These units were both from the Voronezh Front, led by Army General Nikolai Vatutin. Where they arrived was the Bukrin Bend, and you'll see that in the map I put on the webpage for this episode. The Bukrin Bend is a U-shaped curve in the Dnipro River that sticks out northeast about 80 kilometers downstream from Kyiv. Today, the western or right bank is a national park. Now, what this effectively made was when the Germans were occupying it, they were actually in a salient, so a bulge in the line that sticks into the enemy's area, which means that the Red Army can line up on the eastern bank of the river, which allowed them to fire their artillery into the German positions from three sides. In addition to that, small units of the Red Army managed to cross the river often on improvised boats and rafts and other craft. There are even stories of how they would tie their greatcoats together or other tarpaulins together and stuff them with straw to make something that would float well enough, at least to carry a few men. By the end of 22nd September, the Red Army had established some positions on the right bank and secured a village. I'll quote now from an excellent book I found recently about this part of the war. It's called Retribution, the Soviet Reconquest of Central Ukraine, 1943, by British historian and author Prit Butai. The following days saw the development of what amounted to a race. Could the soldiers of Vatutin's leading armies cross the Dnipro in strength and unite their bridgeheads before German reinforcements could hurry to the area, eliminate the small footholds that had already been gained, and then secure the west bank? Combat engineer units with the two Soviet armies hurry to the riverbank, bringing with them a steady stream of boats of differing sizes. While aircraft of both sides launched attacks to try to give their ground troops much-needed support, the Red Army units steadily reinforced what became known collectively as the Bukrin Bridgehead and continued to widen their hold on the east bank of the Dnipro. End quote. The Soviets also tried a relatively new tactic, sending an airborne mission to land by parachute behind the German lines. They sent two brigades of paratroopers on the night of 25th to 26th September, on 65 transport aircraft. That was the plan. The operation was another typical Red Army mess of inadequate planning and preparation, inexperienced personnel, and inadequate resources. 65 transport planes, including Douglas DC-3s from the U.S., plus bombers to carry supplies, and gliders to drop light artillery and anti-tank guns, were assigned to the task. The plan was that each aircraft would make two or more trips to bring in the necessary men, weapons, artillery, and other supplies. But only 48 of the 65 planned aircraft were available on the day of the mission, the 25th of September. Of the 500 planned missions, the flight there and back, and then reloading and going again, so each of those would be a mission. So of the 500 that were planned, which is a lot in one night for 65 aircraft, only 248 were carried out. That meant each aircraft, on average, did four missions. Plans were only revealed to the officers involved, the people who would be on the ground, on the same day of the mission. So they were going in without much mental preparation and planning of their own. Often, they were given maps as they were boarding the planes that would drop them. And then air crews often missed their targets and dropped the paratroopers far from their intended positions, sometimes as much as 24 miles or 40 kilometers away. Some of the unfortunate paratroopers dropped into the Dnipro River and drowned. 13 of the 248 flights returned to their bases without dropping anyone or anything. Meanwhile, on the West Bank, the Germans were ready for the airborne attack. The 73rd Panzer Grenadier Regiment of the 19th Panzer Division had raced their half-track south from Kiev and fired their machine guns and anti-aircraft guns at the paratroopers as they descended helplessly. Their first to land were supposed to be the Pathfinders, who would set up flares to guide the rest. Most of them failed to do so. Then the Germans had easy pickings as more sorties flew at regular intervals, dropping more targets. The Germans downed several transport planes even before anyone could jump out of them. By the end of the operation that night, more than 4,500 paratroopers jumped out of the various aircraft. A third of them were unable to reach the bridgehead. 10% of those who managed to jump were killed or captured within the first half day of the operation, so by noon on the 26th. Those who reached the ground alive were scattered in small groups. The largest was about 600 men near the town of Kanev at the southern end of the Bukharin Bend. Rather than securing the bridgeheads for larger Red Army forces to cross, they had to fight just to survive. Prit Butai quotes a Red Army soldier who was there, quote, "The Germans pursued us through the countryside and gradually wiped us out. They hunted us with dogs. I buried the notepad," with his radio codes, "on the second day. At first, there were three of us. Then we formed a group of 12 paratroopers. We managed to escape from the roundup for 4 days, but then our luck ran out. We had spent 3 days trying to escape from the constricting circle of our pursuers, but we were tightly surrounded. I survived the battle. We broke up, but there were 14 of us left in a group. Among us was an officer, a commander of a machine gun company, and again we hid, fired back, and broke through toward the Dnipro. But things looked hopeless. We had no food, no water. We ate corn and potatoes from the fields. We couldn't light fires. We took ammunition from the dead. It was impossible to enter any village as ambushes had been sent for us everywhere. We never heard any sounds of battle like an attempted breakthrough towards us from the front line. The Germans and the Vlasovite Cossacks hanged captured paratroopers on telephone poles along the roads." End quote. The Vlasovite Cossacks were Red Army slang for any former Red Army member or a Russian who turned coat and fought for the Germans. In short, the airborne operation failed. It, like so many Red Army operations during the Second World War, was a disaster. And yet, the Germans were not able to hold on. Let's look at why after the short break. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian, Maurice Burry, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941. Just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history. You can find the three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase the three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburryauthor.com. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome back to part 2 of episode 60 of Beyond Barbarossa. Before the break, we're talking about the Red Army's parachute operation across the Dnieper River and how it failed due to bad last-minute planning and poor execution. So now let's look at the German situation. The SS Dark Reich Division, so storied, feared, and powerful at Kursk just 2 months earlier, but of course failing then, retreated across the Dnieper at Kremenchuk, 300 kilometers or 200 miles southeast of Kyiv on the Great River. And then it headed north to the Bukharin Bend to help repel the Red Army bridgehead. The departure of the Das Reich Division from its position there made the German bridgehead on the east side of the river untenable. The remaining Germans at Kremenchuk were being pushed back relentlessly, even though the Red Army forces there were seriously depleted and exhausted. But the Germans were also exhausted. For months, they had been retreating at night and holding new defensive positions the next day. So, like, no rest. Most of their hastily prepared defenses then, when they got to their new positions in the early morning, were inadequate. And even behind their lines, even behind the Dnieper River, they were vulnerable to partisan attacks by all those Ukrainians and Russians and anti-Germans who were living under a brutal occupation. On 27 September, the SS Totenkopf, or Death's Head Division, decided to withdraw west as well, under constant air attack. The Red Army tried to overwhelm the rear guard in the afternoon of the day, sending some 25 tanks to reach the bridges, but the Germans beat them off. Barely. The Germans rushed reinforcements into the Bukharin Bend and planned a huge counterattack to start the next day, the 28th of September. They were able to hold off the Red Army, which was trying to cross the river on pontoon bridges, boats, and whatever else they could find. The troops that did make it across remained isolated in small pockets. The marshy ground on that western side of the Dnieper at that area did not lend itself to armored operations or T-34 tanks. But that cut both ways. The German panzers had just as much difficulties with the terrain as the Soviets did. So when the SS Dark Reich Division, a motorized panzer division, arrived, it suffered higher casualties than it expected, even for the Eastern Front. By the end of the day, it was down to almost no operational tanks. It was withdrawn from the line for rest and repair. Not too far to the west, but far enough to be at least temporarily safe. On the 29th of September, two more panzer divisions launched another attack to try to push the Red Army back across the Dnieper. These were the 7th and 20th Panzer Divisions, supported by the 72nd Infantry Division. They made progress at first until Soviet artillery fire from across the river came down on them. By this point, the Soviets had constructed a bridge that could bear tanks. They were quite clever about the way they did it, too. They had it set up submerged just under the water so that it wasn't easily visible from the air. With this, they were able to launch a surprise attack on the west bank near the village of Grigorovka at the downstream end of the bend. And that ended the German operation. Vatutin's Voronezh Front, the group operating in the Bukharin Bend and around it, tried to break out from there, but that operation failed too. In fact, through October 1943, which was the season presumably of the Rasputitsa or Berezhina, the season of no roads, when it's very muddy because of the fall rains. So through that time, the Voronezh front tried twice to break out of the bridgeheads around the Bukharin Bend and failed both times. It wasn't a stalemate, and there was still a lot of fighting and a lot of dying going on, but neither side was able to achieve much. So Vatutin shifted gears. Instead of continuing to send waves of men across into the Bukharin Bend, he sent the 3rd Guards Tank Army, which was at this point a powerful group, to another bridgehead north of Kiev. This was called Lutezh. On 3rd November 1943, the 3rd Guards Tank Army broke through the German lines and pushed west and southwest. They drove the Germans out of Kiev, capital of Ukraine, on 6th November 1943. A major coup, and we'll look more deeply into it in the next episode. But for now, Vatutin's Voronezh Front, renamed the 1st Ukrainian Front, pushed far west and southwest, scattering Hermann Hoth's depleted 4th Panzer Army. The 1st Ukrainian Front got 90 miles or 150 kilometers west of the Dnipro by late November, before Field Marshal von Manstein, the head of Army Group South, was able to gather enough forces to stop it. And they pushed the Reds halfway back to the Dnipro again. The result? Well, Hitler fired Hermann Hoth, the commander of the 4th Panzer Army, and one of the really the most capable, proven generals on the Eastern Front. Things didn't go much better for Vatutin, but a little bit better. Stalin criticized him, rebuked him for the falling back halfway of what he had gained. But you have to remember, he had, in the end, when it was all over, penetrated 60 kilometers or more from the Dnipro and had recaptured Kiev. So he kept his job. So what can we tell at this point? The end of November 1943. It's just past the halfway point of the story of the Second World War in the USSR. The high point of the Germans, indeed of the entire Axis, is now a year in the past. Many senior German officers are now saying that they see that the war on the Eastern Front is lost. Since the destruction of the 6th Army at Stalingrad in the winter of 1943, the Germans have been pulling back all along the Eastern Front. Overall, from a bird's eye view, it was an orderly, measured retreat, not a rout, not a panic. And they did manage to conduct some operations where they were able to push the Soviets back, at least for a little while. I'm thinking of the Third Battle of Kharkiv. But the autumn of 1943 establishes the pattern most of us in the West associate with the Eastern Front. A slow, bloody, costly, but steady advance of the Red Army westward. Yes, the Germans exact terrible casualties on the Red Army, and the Soviets use full-on frontal attacks, depending on sheer numbers to overwhelm the Germans, as the Russians do now in the 21st century in Ukraine. The thing about this strategy is it works. It's a technique the Soviets will use, particularly Zhukov, to the end of the war. Because the one thing that the USSR had over Germany and that Russia has today is lots of people. By the end of October 1943, the Red Army had established solid bridgeheads across Dnipro. They had broken through the German Ostwall. Despite their best efforts, the Germans were unable to push them back. And in November, the Red Army was about to take another major prize, Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. And that's what we'll look at next episode. For now, thank you for listening to episode 60 of Beyond Barbarossa, still the only English language podcast that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. As always, I've put some maps and photos on the webpage for this episode. You'll find it at beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. Then just click on the title of this episode, not the picture. Unless you want to listen to the episode in your browser. If you do, great. You can listen to all episodes that way or through just about any podcasting platform. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a review or a rating on whichever podcasting platform you use, Apple, Google, Spotify, whatever. It helps others who might not know we exist to find the show. And I'd like to thank all of you who are doing that, who are sharing it and liking it and so on, because, yeah, my numbers are going up substantially lately. So thanks for that. Remember, you can get episodes early and ad-free by supporting through Patreon. It's easy. Type into your browser bar, patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa, and then choose the level of support you're comfortable with. I want to thank everyone who's already supported the podcast. Your help makes a big difference. Do you have something to say to me or to the other listeners? Do you have a comment, a question, a correction? Hope not, but if you do, please reach out to contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. I'd love to hear from you. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina.